right, and we are here. Annette, good morning.
Good morning.
Isn't technology amazing?
It is.
Oh, okay. Right, because I have some going on in my background, and I have to turn that down. Okay, and there we go. Good morning to you and Larry. Right?
Larry. Good morning. Good morning.
Okay.
I'm here. Good morning.
Yeah, yeah. It's mm-hmm. It's always a pleasure to have you in the studio. And when I prepared for this interview, I actually prepared for just Annette, but we're so happy to have you to join us. A Life in the Struggle, Lawrence Ham. Annette, my first question goes out to you. The work that you put in to produce this book, give us an idea of how long it took and what due diligence did you have to do to track down Larry?
It took a lot longer than we had anticipated. We started this book, and actually, I think Larry forgets sometimes how long ago we started this book. I believe it was like in May or June of 2017.
Oh, wow.
And it's been a work in progress. I mean, we set up times to meet. We met often at Panera's, and I recorded and transcribed what was said, and it was just a really long process. Plus, when I started this, I was still working, he was still working, and still going about everything that he was doing in terms of activism. And so, yeah, it was difficult sometimes to catch up with him. We usually met at night, usually around, 6-7 o'clock at night, and then we closed out Panera's and that sort of thing.
But you've made it to the finish line now. And
we made it. Yeah.
And that is a testament to, your overcoming adversity and due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
Larry, have you had the opportunity to take a look at the book yourself yet?
Well, I've been looking at it for 5 years.
Longer than that.
Well, absolutely. Well,
I've been looking at it for 5 years. Well, first of all, let me say this book would not have been possible without the efforts of, without the expert effort of Annette Alston. I mean, Annette is really the catalyst that actually made the book, brought the book into reality. And I just thank her for the patience. I'm not an easy person to work with,
No.
And she has infinite patience. Mm. And I want to thank her for being the primary mover to make it happen. Also want to give a shout out to Todd Burrows.
Yep.
Who also helped with the editing of the book. The book needed a lot of editing. And he was one of the people that put in a lot of time, and he needs to be recognized too. But this really, Annette made this book possible. And I just thank God that he made our paths cross and that she would be inspired to want to do this, because the work she did was invaluable. I mean, truthfully, people get paid thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of dollars to do what she did. And she did it. It was a labor of love. She asked for not only did she not ask for money, she put money into it herself. She invested, and I say money, I'm not just talking about the value of her labor. I mean, she put her labor and her finances in this. I'm honored to have had the privilege to work with her to make this happen.
Well,
but,
I'm.
You know.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I just want to say, Larry, your whole life, what we feared was your story not being told, and because it is a valuable tool in the struggle for those that will be coming after us, coming after you, you know, and so people need to know the sacrifices and the effort that need to be put into making something real, making something happen, changing, making change. And you were about that your whole life, you know, and so I think your story needed to be told, and so did Todd, you know, being the biographer that he is, realized, you know, and he kept saying, somebody's got to write his story. And so, yeah, so this is how that came about, you know.
Well, knowing Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs personally myself, and I get a kick out of saying all of that because I knew him when. And he would say the stories of our lives of black people in America have historically been written by other people. And it is so important for us to document our own history so that we have an accurate account of what really happened and not someone else's interpretation.
Exactly. So Todd has been in our corner the whole way. He really has.
Okay, so
he's upset about us talking about him like this. He's probably listening.
That's okay. Whether or not he's listening doesn't matter, right? Because he was instrumental for helping to make this interview happen, actually. When I asked him, would I be able to interview him? He said, why would you interview me? And we have a book over here coming out. Right. And that's how this happened. Right. And that's full transparency. Right. And that here's a question for you. How many books have you authored so far?
Well, this is my third one. The first one was where I put my toe in the water with a children's book called Very, Very Good Scratch Cat. And I know you remember that one.
Of course.
Richard, because you were out there with me while I was, you know. You were a big support for me while I was out there selling that book, so I appreciated that. And then there was Harriet Tubman for Beginners, and that book I had the opportunity to write again because of Todd. So that was my next foray into authorship. And then there was this. With Lauren Tam, A Struggle in a Life. A Life in the Struggle, rather.
Well, I think we kind of, because my next question was, you know, how did you start your journey as a book author? And it sounds like you pretty much answered that, but I'm going to say it again or ask it again. You know, tell us how you started the journey as a book author.
Okay, so then we have to go back a little further. And there was the book that I never had published called Within the Bricks of Nazareth. And I wrote the book, but it never got published. And that is a regret of mine. But it that, you know, I'm going to leave that alone. But
okay.
I've been a writer, I guess, my whole life in some sense. I wrote the rebellion about the rebellion and the 25th anniversary of that. It tells you how long ago that was. And it was published in the Amsterdam News and the City Sun, and actually won an award with the a national award and PR award at that time. And so that was... you know, I've been writing my whole life, but, and I guess I've been building up to this my whole life.
Okay, I'm going to let you off the hook with that one. Give us the title of this current project with that explains, you know, give us the title and talk about the cover, talk about the introduction.
Of Martam, A Life Within the Struggle?
Yes.
Okay, so really, it's about Lars's life and as it chronicles actually the Black Power movement and beyond. It's a history book in the sense of Black struggles since the 1970s on, when he first really got involved in it. And it really details the struggles that come with being an activist, fighting with what you believe and know needs to be changed. He was part of the fight against apartheid in Princeton University, and on and beyond, actually, Princeton. He was in the forefront of the fight for better living situations for people who were without heat and hot water and actually have to eat. That pretty much was one of the ways that POP really got started with that. And then, you know, police brutality and...
okay, so I don't want you to give... I don't want you to give too much of the book away. And so my next question goes to Larry Ham. Larry, you know, I've been talking to people and I have my own viewpoints and opinion, but I'm going to spit one out that I heard. And that is, you know, the Black movement, the Black Power movement of the 60s and 70s today is dead. Larry, what would you say to that statement?
That the Black Power movement, the movement for Black liberation, the movement for Black freedom has never died. It has certainly ebbed and flowed. I mean, there are periods of high tide, so to speak, if we could compare it to the waxing and waning of the ocean, the moving in and out of the tide. You know, there are low periods when there are not a lot of activity, and then there are high periods. So we might look at it separately, but it's really not the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, what was it? It was a part of the Black liberation struggle. It was yet another episode of the Black liberation struggle, you know, and that's a recent movement. I mean, we could look at the struggle against apartheid. I mean, that was an international struggle. I mean, that was a Black people struggle. Black people weren't the only ones. There were other people, other peoples involved in that, but it certainly was seen as part of the worldwide Black liberation struggle. So the movement ebbs, the movement flows, there are high tides, there are low tides, there are times when the river is overflowing, and then there are times when the river is running low, but the river is always there. It's like the Amazon. It's like the Nile. You know, Nile River is never going to disappear. Amazon is never going to disappear. You know, there'll be dry seasons, and there'll be flood seasons. So, you know, that's the way it works. So we might be like, at this moment, you know, at a low tide, and I say this moment, I am talking about like 2024. But I mean, just think, the movement for George Floyd was just a little less than 3.5 years ago, and that was a high tide. There was demonstrations. It was a young people's movement. But one could make an argument that the Black Power movement was a young people's movement in many respects.
That's right.
Not exclusively, but certainly that was a major feature of it. So I think That's how I would look at it. You know, our movement, our struggle never dies, has never died. You know, it's just that there are periods. And then, you know, and then there are periods when there are different kinds of activity. Like, people think of Black Liberation Struggle. I know a lot of people are thinking like the rebellions of the 1960s. I mean, we haven't had a period like that since the 1960s, although there have been rebellions. I mean, you think about it, Los Angeles with Rodney King, that was 25 years after the uprisings of the 60s. You know, there have been various rebellions, but don't get away from the point I'm trying to make now, that in different periods, there are different types of activity. But you take the 1980s, right? You take Jesse Jackson. That was a high tide of activity for Black people. Black people in the United States. I mean, I'm speaking of what I know, right? This is the real essence of this book, that in many respects, I'm an eyewitness. I'm one of the eyewitnesses, you know, of the last 60 years, so to speak, 50 or 60 years. It wasn't like the rebellions of the 1960s, but brother, Black people were organizing and mobilizing all across this country. I mean, it was on everybody's lips, run, Jesse, run. You know, I mean, it was 30 years ago, and a lot of people don't talk about it now, but, man, there wasn't a church that you could go to, you know, where people weren't organizing, you know, to help Jesse with his 1984 and 1988 campaign. And then look, not even 10 years later, the Million Man March. You know, that wasn't like the 1960s, but brother, I'm a witness. I'm alive to tell you. You know,
yeah,
yourself. You know, Black men were organized and mobilized. We were going around this state, New Jersey. Every time there was a Million Man March meeting, it was packed out. I'm not exaggerating here. I'm not engaging hyperbole. When we organized New Jersey Million Man March Coalition, we would go from city to city having meetings. And it was like, I told somebody when we went to Atlantic City, I said, man, it's almost like we got some kind of government going, you know, because the people was coming out, you know, they were packing out the school auditoriums, the churches, everywhere we went to organize for the Million Man March. So in different periods, there have been different types of activities. In different periods, there have been different levels of intensity, but the movement has never stopped.
Go ahead,
Annette. I just needed to interject for a moment because, see, he talks about an eyewitness, but he was an active. Notice he said we organized, we went about. He was an active participant in every movement, every part of the movement from the teacher strikes actually on up through the you know, the present. He was an active participant. He wasn't just an eyewitness. And so that's what makes his story so profound. Because he was part of history. He was just, certain things would not have happened the way they happened without him, to be honest.
Okay, so Annette, now that we got you back on, right, I have a question for you. Now, what is your relationship outside of this book with the struggle?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think my parents kind of prepared me for this a long time ago because they were always active. They were always a part of what was going on in the community. They made sure that they were at the board meeting. They were at the council meetings. They went about getting information out to people. They hosted the mayor at the house one time, Kenneth Gibson, at a block association meeting. I mean, those are the kind of things that they did. So growing up in that, you know, I was always connected, I think, to the Black Power movement, if you will, and to empowerment. And, you know, I met Larry at a very young age because of my parents' involvement. And then when Larry, you know, got out of school, came back from Princeton and started with the apartheid demonstrations and such, you know, we reconnected, basically. You know, so it was just, you know, and actually I mentioned that later on in the book, kind of met him again. I was also in school, basically. I think I was doing my internship and stuff at that time, and at Rutgers. And I, you know, I would see him running down South Orange Avenue. And I didn't know who he was at that time. I mean, you know, years had passed, and I didn't realize who he was. But, you know, after a while, kind of, you know, connected, and I was like, oh, you know, I remember, you know, I remember my parents talking about you, you know. So we just started, you know, I just started going to the meetings. You know, I guess I was one of the earliest members of POP that's still around, and because I really started going to, I mean, I was in and out of POP, but I started really in the 1980s going to some of the meetings. I remember when you had meetings over at Richard Camerari, I'm saying over that
North Coalition,
yeah,
like North Coalition for Neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Above the Ward Coffee Shop.
Yes. I think that's when I first started coming to.
Yeah, that was the early period.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm itching to say this. You know, I did have to ask that question about whether the movement is still alive. Leroy Wilson III, former director of Seton Hall Outward Bound, used to talk about educators and how some of them would feel like they were burned out. And he would directly say, well, you know, my brother, my sister, maybe you've never been lit. And then I would compare that to that same question that I asked Larry and say that if there is no movement, then maybe there is no movement in you. If there is no struggle for you to see, maybe there is no struggle that you see. That leads me to another question to Larry. How do we get people to identify how they can participate? We talk about, you know, I just asked Annette what is her experience in the struggle, but actually her work speaks for her. If we look at some of the books that she's actually published, that says a lot. What would you say to the people out there that need to get involved, Larry?
Well, I would urge them to read this book. That's one thing I would do. And why would I urge them to read this book? Would I urge them to read this book simply because it's my story or it's Annette's writing? No, I urge them to read this book because I think that my life is a reflection in many ways of the life of an ordinary person. This is one of the reasons I wanted it to be the title, A Life in the Struggle, because I wasn't in the struggle by myself.
That's right.
I was one of hundreds of thousands of people across the country that were in this struggle, maybe even millions of people who were in the struggle. And I think by looking at my life, see, I'm a regular person. I'm not really like an extraordinary, but I'm not like a Mary Baraka. You know, Amiri Baraka was a giant. Like, there'll never be another Amiri Baraka. There'll be other great people who may be as great or greater than him. But he was uniquely outstanding individual. You know, I'm a guy that lived in the neighborhood. You know, I was lucky enough to go to college, like a lot of my generation. Well, my life, in many respects, is much like the life of a regular person who's not like a quote-unquote great leader, you know. And I'm hoping that by looking at my life, that it will show them that they too, as regular people, ordinary people, can make, you know, an outstanding contribution to our struggle, not only for Black liberation, but for worldwide transformation. You know, in struggling to change the United States, we will be struggling to change the world. Because the system and forces that exist within the United States are not isolated to the North American continent or to the 50 states of the United States. What goes on in the United States and throughout the world is really the result of a worldwide system, a worldwide political system and economic system. So when we struggle to transform things here in this country, it will affect people abroad. And when people abroad struggle to change their countries, their nation, it affects us here. And the anti-apartheid movement is a good example of that. But it's not the only example of that. You know, there was always a dialectical link between the anti-colonial struggles that were going on in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and the struggle for Black freedom and liberation in this country. I mean, even going all the way back to slavery, you know, there were struggles going on the continent and in the diaspora that affected us here. I mean, look at Haiti. Look at Haiti in the Caribbean. If it wasn't for the Haitian Revolution, our enslavement may have continued into the 20th century. The Haitian Revolution was really one of the dynamic engines that pushed forward the struggle for the abolition of slavery. I mean, it was the Haitian Revolution that, in essence, forced the British to abolish the international trade in slaves. And remember, they did that, like, right after the culmination of the Haitian Revolution, which I think started from 1791 to 1806, something like that, the Haitian Revolution. I mean, people think the Haitian Revolution was like 1 year.
Hello? Okay, we seem like we lost Larry for a minute.
Okay.
I think he might have hit the mute button on his phone while talking.
I'm gonna call him back.
No. Let's continue, right? And maybe we can have him call you back. But would you encourage young people to become writers and authors?
Well, absolutely. I would also encourage them to be readers. Because I mean, people talk about they want to write the book, but they don't read books. And I remember an interview with Maya Angelou and James Baldwin, where they were interviewing each other. But one of the things that came out of that interview was their continuous need to read, you know, other people's work, and you know, just to read. And that's a part of writing. People forget that. You know, because you have to know what good writing is, and before you can really write well, and that's one of the things that Richard Todd has always Todd has been like a mentor to me, really, in terms of writing. And he would always suggest books to me that I should read, and you know, and such. And I found it to be really incredibly helpful to read books that are written well by really great writers. And that's how you become a great writer, you know, is you know what good writing looks like. You have to know what good writing looks like.
Okay.
You know?
All right. So now I'm ready to wrap this up, but I'm going to allow you to call back in. But before I do, now, in conclusion, right, could you share an inspiring story or point of view for the audience? It doesn't have to be about the book. It can be. But an inspiring story to help inspire our audience to get involved. Yeah.
One of the things I was thinking about, and it is connected to the book, was, you know, really in the vein of what Larry was saying about, you know, him being a normal, ordinary person. And a lot of our struggles, a lot of the catalyst is often into the struggle. It comes out of ordinary circumstances. And in his case, it was the teacher strike, the New York teacher strike. He was in high school, Artai, and he was, you know, they were close to not graduating because they had missed about close to 35 days of school at that point.
If not
and
more.
And so they knew.
I said, if not more.
Yeah, if not more. And they were in danger of not graduating. Now, he was in his senior year. He had been accepted to Princeton, I think Harvard. And, you know, he was not going to, you know, he was like, look, I am not going to lose my opportunity to do what I need to do for the rest of my life because these adults can't get their act together. And so he used his position as what they called at the time mayor of Arts High School, was actually the president of the student body at Arts High School, to organize students and say, look, we're in danger of not graduating. We have to bring this strike to an end and get these adults to start talking and do what they need to do. So he organized, and at the risk of not graduating because the principal had found out about this this walkout and had threatened Larry the day before that if he followed through with it, he would not graduate. And, you know, he decided he was going to go ahead and do it anyway because I guess, you know, he was thinking, I may not graduate anyway. So Larry's calling in. I'm gonna pull him in. If it's okay with you.
Yeah, fine.
Okay.
Have them friends, ones we can't depend on. Friends, how many of us have them? Friends, before we go any further, let's be friends.
For most of the time in the wrong way, though you can look the word up again and again. The dictionary, there's another meaning of friends. And if you ask me, I couldn't be myself. Cause a friend is somebody you judge for yourself. Some are okay and they treat you real cool. Some mistake your comments for being a fool. You like to be with some because they're funny. Others come around when they need some money. Some you grew up with the ride the way. And you're still real close to the spending day.
friends. Friends.
Dedicated to my son that's about to be born. So by the time you people hear this record, my son will be born.
Okay, so we're back. Annette, are you there?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and technology is genius, okay?
It has ups and downs.
Okay, ebbs and flows. All right, Larry, you were about to, you got cut off. How about that? So I'd like to give you an opportunity to kind of wrap it up and finish your statement, if you can recall.
Oh, well, I think what I was talking about when we were cut off, and I'll just say this in short, is that there's always been a relationship between the struggle for Black liberation in this country and the struggle for liberation abroad, you know, and I don't know where we got cut off at, but I was talking about Haiti and how Haiti gave the impetus to the movement for abolition. In fact, Haiti was one of the Haitian Revolution was one of the main reasons that the British had abolished the international slave trade. And then ultimately that led to the Civil War in this country. And then, you know, during the Jim Crow period, the pressure of the anti-colonial struggles in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, particularly in Africa, because remember, the United States had just come out of, and many countries had just come out of World War II, but the United States had come out as the world leader. The great powers of Europe had destroyed themselves in World War II. So the United States was proclaiming itself the champion of democracy. But there were a lot of folks in other countries, particularly in the socialist camp, because remember, the Soviet Union was in existence and also came out of World War II, a great power. And they were saying, well, how can you be the champion of democracy when you have, you know, the oppressed Black masses in your own country who are living under apartheid? Because the first apartheid state was the United States, you know, not South Africa.
How about that?
You know, and so the pressure from the outside, pressure from our brothers and sisters struggling against colonialism in Africa and also in Asia and in Latin America, and pressure from the socialist camp, which was the Soviet Union, you know, also helped, you know, because the United States, how could the United States stand in the well of the United Nations and talk about democracy, when Black people couldn't vote, were being lynched, you know, and were living the worst type of existence in the United States. So that external pressure also helped bring about the success of the civil rights movement. So there will always be this dialectic between the struggle within the country and the struggles going on with other oppressed peoples throughout the world. So, you know, I just mentioned that, you know, one feature of our revolutionary struggle. So I just end by saying that once again, I want to thank Annette for all of her. She was uniquely qualified to do this work because Annette was a leader in her own right. I mean, you only asked about Annette Austin, the writer, but Annette Austin was an organizer, a leader in her own right. She was the president of the Newark Teachers Union twice, not once, but in two different periods. She was president of the Newark Teachers Union and Newark Teachers Association, right? There are two. There's the Newark Teachers Association and the Newark Teachers Union. But she was president of the Newark Teachers Association, and the NTA worked with many other organizations on social justice project. So she's a leader in her own right. She grew up in Newark. I grew up in Newark. In fact, at one time we lived literally in the same neighborhood. We lived down the street from one another on West End Avenue. She was a member of an active member, as she said, one of the active early members of the People's Organization for Progress. So she was uniquely qualified, you know, to do this. And we're finally here. It was a torturous path. You know, I don't know if I'll ever write another book again.
Okay. ladies and gentlemen, that is the voice of Lawrence Ham. We call him Larry. We know him, right? A Life in the Struggle. We urge you to do some reading and find out the information on your own. Don't leave yourself victim to what somebody else tells you. How'd I do this, guy, this morning? And let's wrap it up. I want to thank you, Annette Austin, Lawrence Larry Ham. Thank you very much. And, yeah, I did want to ask you, how'd we do?
Great.
I think you did very well.
Okay.
I think you got a lot of information out. And thank you for having us.
Thank you for joining us.
And don't forget the book launch on March 9th
at the Newark Public Library,
3 p.m. 3 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then I'll definitely.
Public Square is also going to
be. I will definitely revisit that. But right now we have to go. Thank you so much, guys. And I will talk to you soon. And I want to say thank you to the audience for tuning in to another edition of Quest Community Vibrations, better known as Quest Youth Radio, which is the best youth radio, airing every Saturday morning from 7 to 8 a.m. live on 89.5 from the campus of Seton Hall in South Orange. Until next Saturday, peace.
Down my dead end street, would you like to come with me? Village ghetto.